From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're continuing our conversation about community safety. It's a pressing issue here in the Cape Fear region. It's also one of the four key pillars of the new Hanover Community Endowment. Now, the endowment still hasn't hired a dedicated network officer to help convene experts and nonprofits and public figures on this issue, but that doesn't mean there aren't lots of people invested in the problem. This year, I'll be sitting down with as many of those people as I can. And that definitely includes today's guest, Abdul Hafid bin Abdullah, or as most people call him to keep it simple, Abdullah, founder and director of Sakota House and co-founder of Quality Life Blueprint, a community organization that takes a public health approach to violence, which understands the visceral violence of guns, crime, and drugs in terms of the underlying systemic violence of inequality, trauma, and other factors. Abdullah agreed to sit down to talk about his perspective on community violence here in Wilmington, his approach to it, and where past efforts like True Colors and Port City United might have fallen short. All right, Abdullah, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you for the invite. I appreciate it.
So I asked you here today because I can't think of too many people in this town who've spent more time thinking about community safety and community violence.
Yes, sir.
So before we get into your work and what might change in this town, I'm just curious, what do those terms mean to you? What does community safety and what does community violence mean to you?
So I always translate both those terms to what is the ultimate like source of security, which is like health and well-being. So I look at it through a public health lens. What is the overall environment, right, that's been created to allow for human beings to be able to thrive without being at risk of being harmed? And you have systems that play that role of public safety, law enforcement, the justice center, judges, prison. And then you have the role that community plays and the role that social services plays and the role that not-for-profits plays. So when I'm thinking about public safety, I'm thinking about in which ways can all those parts work together and collaborate together in order to keep the community safe. And we're looking at it from a public health lens primarily because it looks at the upstream. It looks at what is the reason that there's things in the water and what can we do to stop the water from getting in the water in the first place versus constantly trying to take the trash out downstream. How can you prevent it before it's happening? Or at least how, from my perspective, from a community-based lens, how can I create the environment that supports the prevention, right? That supports, right, changing the behaviors, that support creating informal and formal infrastructures to be able to actually inhibit, right, people from even thinking that they can get away with harming somebody, or even worse than that, believing that they have the right to harm somebody. So there's a behavioral piece that you have to address on the front end. And then there's this piece around consequence. What are the actual structures in place that's going to hold me accountable, right, and then try to correct the behavior? That's when you start getting into law enforcement, prisons, juvenile justice, et cetera, et cetera. So to me, it's a pathway, and it begins for me in the community.
So some of this overlaps with, you know, theories like social determinants of health,
absolutely,
socioeconomic determinants of crime. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions I get a lot from people is they feel, if I can just be candid, they feel like this lets people off the hook a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say, you remember the Dear Officer Crumkey, we're not depraved, we're deprived.
Yes, yes, I got you, yes.
So how do you see the issue of ACEs and mm-hmm. and socioeconomics versus personal responsibility when it comes to issues like crime?
So I think it has a symbiotic relationship, right? You can't say either or. Hurt people, traumatized people have a tendency to traumatize people. And one of the forms of trauma that's most pervasive in our society is the trauma of structural violence. In order for you to address interpersonal violence, which is human beings giving themselves permission to hurt other human beings, to take things from other human beings, robbery, drug sales, right? You know, saying literally poison someone in order to be able to actually survive yourself. All these justifications we make, you have to actually say, okay, in addition to you being personally responsible, I need to also figure out who's responsible for creating persistent and generational conditions where scarcity resources is a reality, right? Scarcity resources gives a person that permission, like, I got to live out here, right? And if either me or them, right, I got to go sell these drugs, right? And I'm not worried about someone else's addiction. I'm worried about being able to pay my bills. I'm not worried about me hurting someone. I'm worried about not being hurt. So if you have an environment of poverty, right, which is a structural determinant, you have an environment of actual lack of adequate resources for educational matriculation, where you go to these school environments and there's lack of resources for the teachers to be able to properly support the kids that's coming home from an environment where there's high levels of substance abuse, right? High levels of actual domestic violence. There's high levels of just insecurity. If you don't have the investment in the schools, if you don't have the investments in the non-for-profit organizations that can support resource allocation, if you don't have the investment in the proper type of mental health services for someone who's being overwhelmed, right, from a certain type of environment, then you're going to perpetuate a certain behavior, right? Then the person would say, well, if you're perpetuating the behavior, where did the behavior begin? And my belief is this, and I give the example of this all the time. If I have a parent and Child Protective Services goes into a home and they see three children, and two of the children are well taken care of, they have no harm physically visible to them, but one of the children, you go into their room and it looks like they're not only the environment is not healthy for them, but they look malnourished and they look like that they've been harmed, right? The average Child Protective Service will actually either remove the children from the home or hold that parent accountable. It's no different from government. Government is the parent. So if I live in one particular part of the community and that community has all the resources it needs, has all the opportunities available to them, and just literally 3-4 miles down the street in the same environment that the government is responsible for, there's lack of resources, there's lack of infrastructures in the streets, there's lack of parks, there's lack of programs. That is a form of abuse. That's a form of harm. And the reality is that people respond to harm in a way that doesn't make any sense. They harm themselves and they harm others. Not all people, but many of the people in those conditions. Some people overcome it and they thrive. So to me, the connection is mutual accountability. Whatever behavior allows for people in positions of policy and resource allocation to kind of almost ignore, right, the causes of the behaviors inside those communities is no different from that individual that picks up a gun or the individual that picks up a dope sack and decides that they want to actually get over by harming somebody else. And I believe if the behavior is persistent, right, if you have historical and generational poverty, historical and generational divestment in certain communities, that's a deliberate behavior. That's a form of harm. So to me, it's mutual. Like, I do believe that individuals that choose to actually indiscriminately hurt other people, right, should be held accountable. They should go to jail. And when they're in jail, right, they should get some form of instruction for opportunities for rehabilitation. And when they come home, they should be monitored. And once they show that they restored and repaired that behavior, then they should be able to allow to function in society like everybody else. But I'm not going to also ignore that there's other behaviors that need to be rehabilitated. That's even more impactful. So it's a mutual thing.
I got you. I've also heard this described a little bit like a bell curve, right, where you've got on one end of the bell curve, you've got people who, regardless of the inequities and the trauma, are just going to rise above. And then people on the other end of the bell curve who are bad actors, you know, and you could be raised in the bougiest, wealthiest Connecticut town and become and take on this kill or be killed mentality on Wall Street, right? Just not care about who you hurt for profit. And then in the middle is most people.
Yes. But what we're talking about is the disproportionate representation of certain behaviors and environments.
Yeah.
Any environment you go into where you see a disproportionate representation of violence and people with criminal backgrounds, in that same environment, you're going to find a series of things. You're going to find economic instability. You're going to find food deserts. You're going to find divestment inside of school and after-school programs. You're going to find corner stores that are selling mostly food that doesn't nourish the people. So you have instances of chronic disease going on inside that community because of lack of transportation to get to the places where there is food. You can literally do a grid through geomapping. And you can see the same places where you see poverty and all these other social insecurities, it's the same places where you see the highest rates of violence, the highest presence of police, and the highest cases of people living in social insecurity, right? So there has to be a connection there, right? You can't go to a particular community and actually you see people living healthy and well, and then all of a sudden you say that there's more violence there than there is in other places. That's not the norm. The norm is wherever that violence is at, and wherever you see people being overly represented in the criminal justice system, you also see a myriad of other type of social insecurities, right? And it's things that can be done to actually address it. And it looks like investment. Whereas what happens is you find the alternative. You see divestment, lack of stores, lack of job opportunities, lack of businesses, lack of incentives for businesses to come. And usually when they come, Ben, this is interesting, right? They're usually coming because they want to remove that population out of that environment and replace it with other populations that have resources so they can go ahead and do what they call urban renewal, right?
Yes.
Gentrification.
You can call it gentrification or the search for lower rent or
whatever it may be, right?
Renewal. Yeah. So we'll have some links to your formal academic paper, but I'm wondering if you can give people like a lay explanation of some of the work that you've been doing.
So the essence of the work that I've done is really, I got blessed with that. First of all, I grew up inside of Southern California. I grew up, unfortunately, inside of the murk and mire of gang culture, street culture. I'm from San Bernardino, about 20, 30 minutes away from Los Angeles, California. So I grew up in the late 80s, going into the 90s. I was arrested at age 17. Spent, 8 years in California Department of Corrections, level 4 prison yard. So I've seen it in the streets, and I've seen it at the highest levels in prisons. About midway into my prison degree, I went through a personal transformation that allowed me to start observing the behavior, the pathology of violence, right? So fast forward, I come home, I want to help my community, and I got a chance to get exposed to a program out of Portland, Oregon, that was funded by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention called Striving to Reduce Youth Violence Everywhere. Spent 5 years there, very successful program. Was going to try to go to Harvard University to look at possibly trying to get the degree in order to scale that program. And then I came here to Wilmington, North Carolina, and I got the opportunity to be kind of a co-author on the document that took all 5 years of that program, right, and actually legitimized it, right, and then had my name on it. So I decided I was going to go ahead and take that program. Instead of going to Harvard, I was going to put my boots on the ground and try to duplicate what happened inside of Portland, Oregon. I called it Community-Based Public Health Response to Violence. I came here in 2016. And I've been working on it since then. Everything that you might have read or heard about is based off that work happened. So what is it? So outside of the CDC funding and the CDC funded research that backed it and the evidence-based programs that was connected to it, the heart of what it is the science of building a community-based ecosystem, right? So when you think about just overall, right, you have within a larger ecosystem, you have like small organisms. So like public safety would be considered an organism within itself, but it has its own system. Public health will be an organism, but it has its own system. It's the same thing, right? Community-based entities, right? I call them community-based network, community professionals and leaders, community-based organizations, and then their networks, from the religious networks on down to the children, on down to the families. How do you activate that particular ecosystem in order to be able to equally partner and support with the larger stakeholders in the actual realms of public safety? And why is that important? Because 90%+ of actual violence and crime happens before police get there. 90%+ of violence and crime happens before the social worker gets there, right? So the people who's really preventing violence and negotiating violence and the actual behaviors on a daily basis are the people most exposed to it. So when you begin to actually invest in actual strategies, youth empowerment, right, community professionals, people with lived experience, community health workers, people who's come from the violence, understood it and actually been able to come out of it, has figured out ways to navigate coming home from prison, right, and having a felony and being able to get a job. Women that's been able to overcome, the human trafficking world, right, and all the issues that come along with that are domestic violence. Activating those professionals to take their lived experience and then couple it with very strategically trained public health thinking to then be deployed into their communities as actual sources of actually activating behavioral change while at the same time, right, allocating resources to the people who need it, connecting them to the actual economic opportunities, connecting them to the trades at the community college, connecting them to the social workers that may be able to help them beyond what they can do. So kind of being a liaison. Activating those professionals inside the community where they come from to then stand up and be able to respond to the behavior in their communities while doing what? Properly and professionally partnering with the various mechanisms and stakeholders that's been employed and been given money to address the problem, but can't do it because there's very little trust.
I want to help paint a picture for people that they can like see in their mind's eye. So at an organic level, right?
Yes.
We could be talking about the guy who owns the corner store or a barber or a pastor, you know, someone who's going to see the signs of violence, like you said, long before the cops do, long before DSS does, and maybe intervene, maybe a coach or, but someone in their community that a kid would trust or a young person would trust.
Yes. So what you have is you have professionals trained, community health workers are professionals trained to then go engage those very people you mentioned and help them develop informal networks, right, and to be able to develop a certain type of infrastructure, social infrastructure that gives the power back to the community. So me, if I'm from Wilmington, North Carolina, right, and I used to be on these streets and I used to terrorize these streets and the police finally got to me and I went to prison for 5-6 years. I came home and I had an actual change of heart, right, and I want to do something good for my community. So I come and I get trained inside this particular model, right, of community health workers and virus prevention and the CPRV model. So we're engaging young people. We have a certain methodology of educating. We use art. We use music. We use, you know what I'm saying, theater to be able to engage the community. So we're not asking community members to come to a classroom. We're going to where they're at. We're offering them to come to a center. And then we're talking about multiple forms of violence. We're not just talking about gang violence, because every person that has a gun in their hand that's willing to shoot somebody has been hurt probably several times before they ever decided to put that gun in their hand. Child molestation, domestic violence, bullying.
Neglect,
any of those things. So we're saying that that person then goes into the community and engages the community with other professionals to try to actually empower the community to understand that they have the greatest leverage to be able to actually shift the norms inside their community. They just have to be given the tools. So before they've been given the tools, you have to build cohesion and relationships. Right. So you're connecting them. You're getting them more confident to work with each other, because trauma and violence has created a separation, conflict. Certain parents and families don't talk to each other no more, even in their own family, let alone neighbors, because of fear and the environment that's there. So what they're doing is tapping into something that's already there, and they're being educating them on how to leverage that to be able to actually create more safety and more health in the community. Once they have that, then they're actually operationalizing that to interface with law enforcement, to interface with juvenile justice, to interface with the schools, to be able to say, I can support you in doing what you've been mandated to do. Where you're missing the actual point, I can connect that dot for you, right? And we have to work together.
So could this look like, for example, you've got a single mother or a single father, and they're struggling financially.
Yes.
And that leads to, even if it's not, you know, malicious, it's still a kind of neglect because they're working, say, two jobs, right?
Yeah.
So you got a kid who's growing up, latchkey kid, as we used to call it, and that neglect puts you at risk, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of other influences that'll fill the void of a parent pretty quickly.
1,000%.
So could that look like, okay, let's help this parent maybe make ends meet,
yes,
get groceries, maybe find a employment that,
yes,
is more beneficial.
And find some activities for the young person.
And find some, right, activities for the young person.
And the activities for the young person is including equipping the young person to understand the actual dynamics of peer pressure, right? And understanding this is what you're going to encounter out here. The music, right? The TV, right? The school itself, they're making, like, violence and sex, you know what I'm saying, cool, right? So you have to understand what that really means for you. Gang culture looks cool. If you're being neglected at home, like you just mentioned, just a subtle neglect, not an actual real child abuse. Right. But imagine if it's child abuse at home. Right. Imagine if someone's really, yeah, causing harm. Then you begin to look at the other people who's claiming that they have this type of respect and love for each other. And I'm willing to die for you. And I'm willing to do anything to make sure that we're safe and we can actually overcome this situation. They think that this is something that's beneficial for them. But the essence of gang culture and street culture is rooted in treachery. There's nothing good about it. There's nothing you're going to achieve from it. But the perception.
Right.
Makes you feel like I can get that there when I'm missing at home.
So kids are seeing season one of Sons of Anarchy, not,
yes,
season five of Sons of Anarchy.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
And it's amazing to them.
And it's easy for me to understand how I was in a punk rock band as a kid.
Okay,
and that's what saved me, because a lot of my friends ended up,
yeah,
Into heavy drugs,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just played terrible music, and that but that saved my life, right?
Yeah,
that gave me something to do, and I can see how attractive when you're bored or you feel neglected or even just misunderstood.
Yeah.
You know, so what I can't imagine is you start layering on, you know, some heavy layers of poverty and physical abuse, sexual,
yes,
abuse, stuff like that.
Drugs.
Right. I can only imagine how attractive
exactly
the superficial appearance of fraternity is.
Exactly. And that's simply what it represents, a type of fraternity, but it's very superficial.
Yeah. So do you buy, I know you can't speak for every gang everywhere,
yeah,
but like, do you buy this argument that there are some gangs that really are what they say they are, that they really are a fraternal group?
No. And I talk to any gang member or any gang banger. I used to be that. I wasn't a gang member. I was a gang banger, right? I used to literally wake up in the morning by the time I got full throttle, and I would be that guy out there, and all I was looking for is to get into something, right? At a certain point, there's some survival. Right. You're responding to your condition. You see people inside the gangs. Right. They're not necessarily afraid of people. You see people in the gangs. They have money. Right. At lunch, when nobody else has money at lunch, you see they're selling a little bit of something. They're doing a little bit of gambling here and there. And you do what you have to do to survive. But at some point, you begin to notice and you begin to see that what it is you're a part of is not what you thought it was. Right. And then even beyond that, so you maintain some level of presence, but you're aware that this is not what you thought it was. But you stay present in it. But then there's another level of individuals that began to actually take on a more enhanced behavior. It's like a profession, right? Some gang members, like a regular job, they get in and they want to actually become more and they want to excel. There's no way for you to excel in gang culture without turning down your moral compass, right? Because the ideal of becoming, they say, you know, they have a saying, turn down for what? That's the language they used to say back in the days, right? Now they're using, like, I'm on demon time. So turn down for what means turn down your moral compass. I don't care about anyone. And the more people see I don't care, the more I'm empowered in this culture, right? And to me, right, there's no excuse at that point. To me, you are a threat to anyone and everyone. Now, are you still someone's child? Are you still someone that's in my community? Can I still engage you and embrace you? Absolutely. But I'm going to call it what it is, right? You're willing to hurt other human beings in order to excel professionally in the choice that you've chosen. At that point, and I believe that law enforcement comes in and has to play the role that they're actually been designed to play. But there's about 70%, even 65%, I would say, 65 to 70% of people that's involved in street culture and gang culture, right, that are, you can engage them. They haven't reached that point to where the moral compass has been turned down. There's opportunities for them to be able to do something different. But the resources have to be in place for the actual networks, the community-based networks and otherwise, to offer them something legitimate.
All right, well, we need to take a break, but we'll be back with more from my conversation with Abdul Hafid bin Abdullah, talking about the relationship between crime and community. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for staying with us. We return now to our conversation about community safety with Abdul Hafid bin Abdullah, founder of Sakota House and a community health professional.
So I want to talk a little bit more about this relationship between the community and gangs and law enforcement, these different ecosystems maybe.
Yeah.
And one of the things I've seen is that when, not just gang violence, when violence in general gets to a certain point, communities like collapse into cells of single households because everyone is just trying to protect themselves and make it through the day. And that seems to be, again, as an outsider, kind of part of what creates this code of silence, a MRTA, no snitch culture, whatever you want to call it. Different cultures have different lingo for it. But, you know, how do you get past that? Because when there are bad actors, right, people who are, they've crossed that line that you've sort of laid out. And now they're just a menace. Now they're just gonna harm their own people in their own community.
Yeah.
But their own community is scared to engage with law enforcement or scared to engage with the SS or whatever. Yes. How can you sort of repair that?
So this is the thing. So what we're talking about is honor amongst thieves, right? It's no different from the honor even within law enforcement, right? You know what I'm saying? And I mean by say that because sometimes the law enforcement doing things they shouldn't be doing, but it's the blue code, right? You know what I'm saying? And they have this strict, if you don't abide by it, then, you know, you're going to be vulnerable while we're out in the field. It's the same thing amongst these thieves. And what I'm calling thieves is actually the gang culture, the street culture. Honor amongst thieves. There's no honor in the community, right, when it comes to actually not holding people accountable. Regular community members who don't carry guns, who work 9-to-5 jobs, right, there was a time inside of our history, right, where those individuals, they didn't have the option to actually go to war, right, with the actual young people or the people that choose to terrorize their community. They just called the police. Right. And it was understood that I'm a civilian. Right. I'm not doing what you're doing. I'm not putting my life on the line on a daily basis. Right. So I'm going to make that phone call and you have to deal with the police. And the counter was that it was like more of a gangster culture, like the old school gangster culture, people that was doing like the running numbers and doing those type of things. They would kind of like choose to hold people accountable informally. Right. It goes all the way back to them. What happened inside of our society deals with mass incarcerations in the 1980s and the 1990s. You talk about single-family homes. That came from, right, the actual multiplication of actual young people going into prisons from the 1980s, from 200,000 to 1 million. By 2010 to 2020, 2.8 million, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Numbers go on, right? Generations upon generations. And that began when we was allowing the cocaine to come into our communities in the 1980s in order to stop the successful Nicaraguan war inside of actual Central and South America.
Oh, yeah. There's a bunch of good documentaries on that.
Exactly.
We'll have links.
I don't want to go there. Right? So, but what I want to say is that if you want to talk about single-family homes, you want to talk about, you know, the actual behaviors and the culture, the no snitch code culture, you got to take it back there because it was in that environment that the mass migration of young men into prisons, which is the most violent place in America and the most organized criminal environment in America, then they come home. You have to understand the connection. So if they come home, 90% of them go to prison, they come home, what culture are they bringing back into our communities, right? So without going too deep into that, right, we want to say, right now, there's not enough communication in the community, right? So my argument is, right, if you can get the streets, right, to allow the civilians to be the civilians, right, live their lives, where the, even the elders say, man, listen, man, leave those people alone. They ain't out here doing what we're doing. And they keep it amongst themselves. Then their responsibility is to navigate the actual entity that's been actually deployed and been hired to address them, which is law enforcement.
Yeah.
And people don't want to hear that because what you're doing is you're quarantining the problem. But when you mix it, you're leaving the community vulnerable. So now what you have is individuals are saying, oh, yeah, we gotta make sure that they quiet. We gotta make sure that they don't say anything. So they, what they have to do then, they have to begin to actually enforce, right, a presence. So now the community is living in fear.
So how do you, I mean, I don't expect no, that's kind of a full answer, but like, how do you empower the community to pull back from that fear and get to a place where they can be quarantined?
Well, first of all, you have to actually, so with the community itself, like you have to create the informal, you know, saying structure. Every person in the community, in the streets or whatnot, has a mother, they have a grandfather, they have somebody in the community. And once you start communicating, that line has to be drawn, right? Like, quit targeting people inside of our community that's not involved in actual gang violence and gang culture, right? And start communicating some type of rationale around that. Even with the young people inside the streets or whatnot, talking to them. Like, man, what good are you doing? You're supposed to be tough and hard or whatnot, but you're hurting people that's not even involved in the street life. And I'm going to give you this piece, man. It's really important. If you can get the streets and the actual culture of gangs to keep their behavior focused on people who's choosing to be a part of that, that becomes less attractive to people, right? Because now they're saying, listen, you know what you're dealing with. You're just dealing with the police. They're coming for you. And you may be dealing with some of these community members because everybody ain't minding their business. Some people going to say something. But what happens is that they understand very clearly what this is and what that is. So if they choose to leave this, they can clearly see what their option is, the alternative is. Right now, you really can't see it. In most places where there's actual gang violence and street violence, right, it's almost everywhere. And it's difficult for people to figure out where they can actually find a sacred place to be.
And they can't see a way out.
They can't see a way out, right? It's there. Don't get me wrong. No community is completely helpless, right? But what we're talking about is elucidating, right, and making clear where the way out is at.
All right. Well, we need to take one more quick break, but we'll be back with more from my conversation with Abdul Hafid bin Abdullah, talking about past violence prevention efforts like True Colors and Port City United. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for staying with us. We return now to our conversation about community safety with Abdul Hafid bin Abdullah, founder of Sakota House and a community health professional. So a lot of this sounds like, you know, bottom up from inside the community work, right?
Yes, it has to happen inside the community. The culture inside the community has to be altered.
So I want to ask you, because you've been here over mm-hmm. the last 8 years and 9 years now.
Yeah.
And you've seen some people from outside of low-income black neighborhoods mm-hmm. try to help, for better or worse, George Taylor with True Colors and then yeah. the county with PCU. Now, some mm-hmm. people who worked for George were from the community, obviously.
Great selections that they chose, like, as a baseline.
So from your point of view, was True Colors on the right track, or was that kind of off kilter?
They was absolutely on the right track, right? George Taylor actually went and studied Homeboy Industries out of Los Angeles, California, and then he studied the Cure Violence Global Model. What he did is that he tried to merge the two models, which was actually a great ideal, but he also merged some of his own ideals inside of it. He thought somehow by requiring these young men to still have gang ties and affiliations was a good ideal, and after people told him,
yeah, so just for people who don't know, Homeboy Industries was yeah. A clothing company that was hiring.
Clothing, coffee shop. They have multiple different.
They had all kinds of cool stuff.
Yeah, they have all type of businesses. What they do is they give individuals opportunities to actually leave the gang culture, right, and actually connect up with their network and then get jobs and change their life around. But right. It was based in economics. The key thing about their program is that it was a known relationship with the streets that if you choose to leave our gang to go be a part of, right? It was a minister that actually was running it, to be a part of what, you know, saying Father such and such is doing, right? And be a part of the Homeboy Industries. I'm telling you, right? If you come back, we're going to treat you like the dirt.
But they would leave you be.
They would leave you 100%
while you were at Homeboy Industries.
Because they respected what was happening.
Because you made a choice.
You made a choice.
And likewise with Cure Violence, I've spoken to the Chicago folks who stood the thing up, and I asked them about this idea of having active gang members, and they said, like, that's a huge liability, and it would have to be an exceptional person, maybe a liaison or something. But say, in general, we didn't want to mix the two.
Yeah, so the model, unfortunately, with Cure Violence, it's an amazing program. I think they do a very good job at intervening and interrupting violence where it's happening in the community. And it's legitimate when it's operating properly. But there's a lot of flexibility how you can implement Cure Violence, right? And a lot of deregulation when it comes to fidelity of what's considered to be an evidence-based program. So how it works, if I had a program where it worked very well, then we're going to celebrate you, we're going to do article peer reviews on you, and everybody's going to say, wow. But if you got somebody got shot 2-3 times, you know what I'm saying, someone got killed in that same city implementing the model, you had what happened with Port City United where people got arrested and all of a sudden the whole program got shut down, we're going to act like it doesn't exist. Cure Violence is an excellent program, let's be clear. But the room to be able to implement how you choose to implement without a legitimate fidelity check for an evidence-based program is a problem.
Yeah.
Right? An example of that is the implementation of it with True Colors as well as with Port City United. So if you ask me the question, were they on the right track? Absolutely. Was there a very critical era? And I don't know the intention of the era, right? I know that it's been multiple conversations from community leaders being very clear that that piece right there is very disruptive and it's backwards. Do not require these young men. It's one thing you gave them the option, but people were required to have the gang ties. That was another thing.
I will say Taylor told me that he didn't require people to be in gangs. I heard differently from people who were in.
Yeah, and that I heard differently too as well.
And that Taylor effectively bragged to people that he was cool. I mean, I'm just going to say it. Like, there was a lot. He had this clout because he was the only white guy accepted by the gangbangers. That's how he portrayed it. His argument was that that's what he needed to stay on the cutting edge of real-time developing acts of violence instead of, as you put it at the beginning of the show, get upstream from it.
Yeah, upstream. And also, too, his program was creating more incidences of violence inside of our city that was known for years. Right, until it actually completely collapsed and imploded. And I'm just going to say this, it needs to be known, right, because people in government needs to hear. Like, you guys allowed someone to run a business, right, with individuals that was actually active known gang members, and the standard of a gang is that groups are collectively together with similar signs, similar objectives, similar goals, right? You basically had a gang operating a business, and because it was a white guy, right, that said he was trying to help the community, even though people was being shot when there was interventions happening, people was being killed when it wasn't interventions happening, a series of them got arrested, we still allowed the program to actually flow until it became too bad. So I'm going to go back to the question. Was he on the right track? Absolutely. What was his intention for that one component that we know harmed his program, right, and harmed the community as a result? I don't know his intention, but I know that very specific issue of gang affiliation, right, was catastrophic to the community, and it made his ideal of bringing together Homeboy Industries and Cure Violence null and void. And so he was on the right track, but I think he made some very critical errors.
And I think that carried over into PCU.
So PCU is quite different. PCU made the error of trying to operate a Cure Violence model inside of the county. So you're going to take individuals who you want to place inside of, you know, environments where crimes is happening and violence is happening, and they're going to be, you know, on county time. They're going to be, some of them tracked with phones and tracked with the vehicles that they have, GPS, right? And you're going to put them inside of a situation where they have to navigate their credibility in the community and their responsibility to the government agency they work for. And their job is to play this gray area of trying to actually prevent violence. And you did so without being humble enough to get adequate training for these young people that you actually hired, right? And again, one last thing is that, again, it too was an actual pilot. Because they have the Cure Violence model. They brought in some components with community health worker model, which we contribute when we was attending their meetings and mentioned to them the need to actually have those hired. But they also had the Port City Connect. That was an addition to their actual program that, again, turned into like a hybrid type of pilot. And that piece right there was problematic because it was an exchange of information that over time would actually cause a point of credibility to be questioned from the people that was actually doing the program. And they changed it. Right, over time. If you ask me about Port City United, I think that they was more on it and more capable. I believe it was a huge opportunity, for our city. But I believe that the leadership, and not the ones that was hired, but the ones that developed the program, experienced some point of sensitivities about some comments that was made, right, and didn't access the expertise that was existing in the community, you saying, myself, Vance Williams, and other professionals been doing the work, right, and refused to actually tap us, right, for certain knowledge that we could have been able to offer to help them be able to actually effectively leverage the professionals that they was actually training. And secondly, you took money, and instead of investing it where it was needed, after you had a vision session, and the community told you that what was needed was to invest in the community, you chose to invest inside the county, right? And you let the county run something that it had not the capacity to understand how to run. And it hurt everybody as a result of it. And just to be clear, although as many community members that was hired, no one can say that the community has been given a legitimate chance to lead a comprehensive strategy inside this community to prevent violence, because the county led that. And I don't care if someone is of a particular ethnic background, right? But if you've been living in the county, working in the county, and you've been trained by the county, and you're still being governed by the county, no matter what your ethnicity is, right, you're still moving according to county standards. And if you're trying to implement something that you want to be organic and you want to actually spread into a shift in culture and the actual network of resources, you need to place that in the place where that's been happening for 20-something, 40, 50 years in the community. And there's enough community-based organizations present, not just Sokoto House, that they could have invested in. Instead, they held on to the money. They contracted some individuals out. But at the heart of it, they ran it in a government agency. And that's what hurt them. But they had a huge opportunity.
I have heard the criticism that some people at the county thought they were empowering Black people by hiring them. And I think, unless I'm mistaken, the point you're making was that it needed to come from the community, regardless of who people were, who was at the top of the department. The idea came from the county, not from the community.
Yeah, but the idea came from the community, and the county ran with it.
Okay, yeah.
Right, let's just be clear, right? And then when they ran with it, they wanted to do their own version of it. Right. You have people inside your environment, right, that some people been working, like Link. It's been dealing with people with exposure to violence for the past, I don't know how many years it's been around, but anyone dealing with populations coming home from prison, they have a better understanding of really the actual pathology of violence. Sokoto House has been around for, at that time, maybe 4 years at the time, but I've been doing this work for 10, 15 years and got some national recognition inside the field, and they knew that as well. I contributed to their ideals in developing what they came up with, which is Poor City United. They chose to not tap the full breadth of resources that was available to them and really understand what the work looks like on the ground. Just to give you a sense, right, so the model that we push, community-based public health response to violence, identified geographic and demographic locations where there's multiple forms of violence happening, not just gun violence, because we know that child molestation, domestic violence, and all type of other forms of insecurity.
Housing insecurity, food insecurity.
All those things are relevant. And we deploy our strategy into that very specific location for a period of time. We have a multi-sectoral coalition to then concentrate in the actual building of that very specific demographic and geographical focus. And they began to build youth leaders, professionals, their networks, the community-based organizations, allocate resources there. And then once they stand that community up, it's then designed to deploy itself to other parts of the actual county and do the exact same thing. So the exact same thing you see inside of Sokoto House on Dawson Street, if it was ever funded properly, it would deploy into the projects in the surrounding area and have its impact. Public health strategy is that you actually define your problem, you assess the risk and protective factors connected to it, you develop a very specific strategy for that very specific program on a low scale, minimum investment. Once you implement and you test and you know it's working, then you scale. You scale within that same community, and then you duplicate it across multiple different other localities in order to then have an actual comprehensive impact inside the actual ecosystem.
I think that's the biggest space of disconnect here between mm-hmm. how the county thought about it, which was, we're going to run this thing out of 305 Chestnut Street mm-hmm. for the whole county.
Yes.
I mean, I know that they had specific areas that they thought were impacted, which mm-hmm. was an issue of itself, because I talked to some people who were dealing with, violence, domestic violence and substance yeah. abuse, but they didn't live in the quote unquote, danger zone. They weren't yeah. They were in a low income white neighborhood yeah. up in Castle Hayne. They weren't in a low income yeah. black neighborhood. And this model didn't work because it was based, it was like a spoke and wheel thing yeah. instead of more like a rhizome,
yeah.
like more of a, an organically spreading thing. That seemed to be an issue. It also seemed to confound them when they thought about how to scale it. Because like you said, this was a pilot program,
yeah.
right? So I'm curious, we've got not unlimited resources, but we got a lot of resources yeah. in this town. And this is an issue that intersects, community safety intersects, as you pointed out, with all these other issues.
Yes.
Transportation, housing, food insecurity,
all of it.
Domestic violence,
health, yeah.
health, mental health, physical yes. health, all that, right? Mm-hmm. So it's certainly worthy of investment, but how would you just like dream out loud for a second?
Yeah.
You know, if you were written a blank check, how would you suggest that get into the community? And
I would identify two target locations. I would identify the worst case scenarios. Where's the most crime happening at? Where's the most shots being fired? Where's the most domestic violence being reported? Right. And I would deploy, right, a certain number of actual professionals that's been properly trained to be into those communities. Our model would be implementing youth development, youth leadership development programming, CEPTED, crime prevention through environmental design. So looking at how the built environment can then be a resource to better actually encourage safety and encourage well-being and health, making sure the parks have, you know, enough visibility with the people being present, natural visibility to actually get the elders out in the community, get the young people out in the community playing. And then I would also initiate health promotion campaigns in that very specific area. So you may grab a hold of a certain number of staff and a certain number of dollars, minimum investment, right, to program. And then you create a multi-sectoral coalition that's led by the community to collectively respond to a particular condition. Once you have a certain level of actual progress in that area, then you begin to look to scale and actually identify another location and then another location. And before you know it, all those locations and all those professionals and all those community networks, they're linked to each other inside of our city. Right. And there's actual active relationships that's been built with the community college, with the actual K through 12 environments, with the, you know, saying public housing and actual regular, you know, saying real estate agents or whatnot that's interested in investing in those areas. Right. Business sector. They're all aware, like the synapses, use the language, right, of the brain cells has been connected. But guess what? You have to have some maintenance. Because the problem is just not going to go away. One of the biggest things about Wilmington right now is this. Let's just be clear. Violence is down. At least gun violence is down.
Yeah, violent crime is down.
But it's not going to remain that way. There's a significant amount of people that actually done left because of prison. And typically when you have certain upticks in actual incarceration, right, those people usually come home around the same time. Right. So they may be going for
similar crimes. Structured sentencing means similar.
Exactly. Similar release. Yeah. Right. And some of those behaviors are coming home. Right. And some of them are coming home. Not right. But what's also happened is that they also got little brothers and they got, you know, sons. Right. And they also have other counterparts that's at the ages of 9, 10 and 11 right now. They're experiencing things. There's other forms of violence that is being exposed in our community. We have to say in our culture that their sin is different. They got the sin of a man. Right. Hmm. So the way that they behave is different. If they're rebellious, they're very rebellious. Sometimes the mother, the grandmothers can't control them. Right. Increasing. And not to mention that the economics. Right. There's been an influx of actual migrants to this particular region, predominantly European migrants. Right. Because Wilmington, North Carolina has been marketed as a place to go to. Well, guess what? There's no secret that there's recreational drug use within all cultures, and the people with the money have more recreational drug use than others. So that's an enhanced drug trade, right? So that means now the market is ripe drug activity.
The cocaine is getting to Wrightsville Beach somehow.
It's getting there, and then at some point, the people in the streets become, right, the suppliers.
Yeah.
You take all those components. If you're not active right now creating a healthy infrastructure for prevention and building the communities, then you leave yourself for a potential of something to unravel that can change the whole landscape of Wilmington, North Carolina.
So here's my last question for you, because I know that you spent a lot of time thinking about this and you've watched it happen in Buncombe County. We'll have links to that program. That's where Asheville is, for people who don't know.
The CPR remodel is being implemented by the actual Justice Service. They put $2.5 million behind it. They're going into the third year currently right now.
So you've dealt with the endowment and the county, United Way, and I know a lot of these traditional funders look for one big organization with quote-unquote capacity. And it is more difficult to wrap your head around what you're talking about. It's more complicated, more people involved.
That would be my communication to anyone who has money, right? Before you put money inside someone's hands, right, to help community that's been needing help for a long time, right, that's been historically not had resources accessible to them, right, make sure that you know what they're going to do with that money. So to answer your question, though, that's the one thing. Because sometimes the culture is, I just want to give a gang of money, I don't want to worry about it, report back to me. That's easy, but my request to you is make them show you what they're doing and make them bring the people to you that's actually doing the work. The alternative is, see, you don't have to invest a lot with our model. Right. Our motto is a traditional public health strategy, right? Invest little and target.
And you're mostly investing in people, right? You're investing in the training.
You're investing in the training, and you're investing inside the actual programming for, like, public health campaigns, the youth, you know what I'm saying, leadership development, right? It's not that big of an investment. What I'm saying is that you scale up. How you scale up is you actually start with testing. So if anyone has a question, which they shouldn't have a question, because a lot of the epistemology that we're talking about is actually helping to actually shift how violence is being looked at across the country, right? And it's happening also across the state as well, too, as we speak. We currently have over 100-something-plus community health workers at Vitus Prevention inside the state of North Carolina, and it's growing. Actually, have another training that's getting ready to happen here with Coastal Horizon, 25 additional CHW on Vitus Prevention professionals happening here locally. It's going to be happening soon. But the point is, our model, the CPRV model, so you have the CPRV model, which is the comprehensive strategy. That's more difficult for people to wrap their minds around. The easiest one is the CHW Vitus Prevention Professional, just training more professionals that be deployed in multiple different organizations.
Community health workers.
Community health workers, right, with expertise in Vitus Prevention, right? Specifically, community health workers have been around for 60-something-plus years, one of the most established community health professionals inside the actual country, community health workers. But we have Vitus Prevention, which is, you know, kind of a recent, maybe less than a half a decade or whatnot, you know, saying a little bit more than that. But the point is this. If you take one or two locations and you say, okay, here's X amount of dollars. You have evidence-based program, you claim. Okay, we're not all the way confident. You have some literature backing it. I read it. You can present to us. You can convince us. All right? And I'm saying, give us a little bit and see what happens with that little bit. Let the results be put on your table. Let your results be analyzed by your epidemiologists. Let your results be analyzed by your experts. And what I'm saying is that we're doing right now inside of Wilmington, North Carolina, with no resources. So Holder House exists with no legitimate money coming from the government. I have another center called Timbuktu Center for Cultural and Spiritual Development, just opened up about 6 months ago right now in Anderson and actual Rankin, in the heart of where the activities happen at. No resources. I'm not getting that from anybody else, right? The community is giving that money. Put some resources behind that, a little bit. And then bring your experts to measure if it's successful, and then make an informed investment after that to see if this is something that, if supported over time, can support transforming the culture of safety, right, and the culture of health inside of our community. We're not asking for everything, right? Most community-based entities and organizations never ask for everything. We're asking for a little bit of what's already not being given, just a little bit of what's already not being given, and put it to the test. And for those that may be listening, that may be uncomfortable, right, because maybe you're dealing with some groups of people that's willing to say things and try to hold people accountable, I just want you to hear, I, as a human being, cannot interact with people inside these communities who I know is willing to hurt other people, and I'm confronting them and actually holding them accountable, trying to convince them to stop their behaviors, and at the same time sleep at night when I know that there's certain systemic behaviors exist and I'm not saying anything to you. I have to say something. If I do something wrong, I expect to be held accountable by everybody, including God. Right? I no doubt that the city will hold me accountable. So what I'm saying is, don't be uncomfortable, right, with a little bit of actual accountability. We want the interpersonal violence to change, and we want to be able to support a shift in systemic behaviors so that people can get on with their lives, feeling like that everybody's doing the best they can do to make the community safer and make the community healthier.
Well, I really appreciate your time today. Anything else you want to say before I let you go?
I just want to say, first of all, I want to thank you for having me here. And I also want to thank Wilmington as a whole, the community, and others, right? You guys are doing a pretty amazing job. Like, violence has gone down inside the community. It's gone down all across the country. But there's been a lot of efforts, government and community, that's actually been able to support making the community safer. You don't see as much gun violence that's out there. But I don't want you guys to sleep on the fact there's a lot of other forms of violence that's happening inside of our community. We got a lot of young people vulnerable. We got a lot of, you know what I'm saying, other things that's happening in our community. Please, right, let's be aware of the multiple forms of violence. Let's be more conscious of the toxic stress that's actually impacting our communities. And we need to come together, man. I know it may be difficult for some of us, and more easier for others, but I think this is the time. If there's any other time, this is the time right here.
Abdullah, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Newsroom. Thanks to my guest, Abdul Hafid bin Abdullah, and to WHQR's Ken Campbell for technical support. Music for this episode came from If These Trees Could Talk and from Blue Dot Sessions. If you missed any part of this program, you can find it at whqr.org or as a podcast wherever you get podcasts. If you have comments, concerns, or just an idea for a future show, email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.